Thank you, thank you. I appreciate that. All right. Well, welcome those who are here and those who are virtually here. And as always, we will get started on time. It is 7:30, so the clock starts ticking. So this week we have a, of course, it's a treat because it's Parshas Yisroi, which is the giving of the Torah, which is a very exciting week. We also sort of, there's a family reunion, but the majority of the Torah portion, which is, and relatively being a small Torah portion, takes up the story of Matan Torah, of the giving of the Torah, and the saying of the 10 utterances, usually referred to as the 10 commandments. I don't like that term, because as we all know, if we don't, you're about to find out, we have a lot more than 10 commandments. We have 613 biblical commandments, along with 7 rabbinic commandments. So saying the 10 commandments is very deceiving, right? It convinces people that our religion is very simple and easy. It's just 10 commandments. That's all it is. And it isn't. So let's be more careful. In Hebrew, the actual translation of 10, Aseres Hadibrois. Dibra in Hebrew does not mean command. It means a speech, a saying, 10 sayings. So that's just, I like pointing that out because we use the term 10 commandments. And you ask somebody, how many commandments do we have? They say, of course, 10. It's easy. But it's not. Okay, so of course, before, well, not necessarily before, when did Yisroi or Jethro arrive in the desert? Now, we know for sure that our Torah portion is not in chronological order, because it first describes the coming of Jethro to the desert and greeting Moses and bringing Moses' wife and 2 children who had been waiting for him in Midian. And then it talks about how Moshe Rabbeinu was judging the Jewish people, and Jethro got involved and gave him a better way of doing this. He said, you have to build a system. You can't do it all yourself. And Rashi tells us that day was the day after Yom Kippur, which is after the whole period of giving of the Torah, the breaking of the Luchos, right, the sin of the golden calf, Moses asking for forgiveness, and only 120 days after the giving of the Torah was Moshe actually judging the Jewish people. And so that part of the story had to have happened after the giving of the Torah, and yet the Torah tells about it afterwards. So obviously, we're not in chronological order. When exactly did Yisroi actually come? Did he become before the giving of the Torah, during that period, afterwards? There's a lot of different opinions, as always, which is actually part of the theme of this week's class, multiple opinions. But of course, God gives the Torah. And then we're ended off with a very quick command about the building of the altar. And that's pretty much what our parsha entails. Only 72 verses, which is a relatively very small Torah portion. Okay, so that's what our parsha talks about. We're actually going to focus on another theme here, as it says in the title, out of 3:1. The people that put together this class, I understandably so, are very careful about using the word Trinity in this class, even though, so they keep referring to it as that three unity. I think that we don't have to be afraid to use a term which obviously belonged to us way before them. So when we say Trinity, we're not referring to a spiritual Trinity of different deities. When we say Trinity, we're referring to, as we'll discuss, the idea of unison from a lot, rather than unison by everything being equal. And we'll get to that, and we'll discuss that in today's class. The big theme here is Ahavas Yisrael, love of our fellow Jew, which, as we know, if you haven't heard about it before, is the famous story with Shammai and Hillel, the convert who came to Shammai and said, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. Shammai kicked him away, sent him flying, said, you can't learn the Torah on one foot. He comes to Hillel, he tells Hillel, can you teach me the Torah on one foot? And he says, of course, what is what you don't like, don't do unto others. And basically the idea of Ahavas Yisrael being the central and most important theme and all-encompassing idea of the Torah. So what does that mean to love your fellow Jew? And I think we touched on this in one of the classes before, but simply put, love your fellow as yourself means what Hillel said. Treat your fellow as yourself. I can hate you, I can be disgusted by you, but I'm going to treat you with respect. That's what we usually assume the idea of loving your fellow as yourself means. Treat others as you would want to be treated. Not, I don't want to be loved by that person, right? I don't need every Gentile in the world to love Jews. I want them to behave as if they do. That's what I care about, right? And same thing with other friends, with Jews, is we want our fellow brothers and sisters to treat us, and we should treat them as we would like to be treated. So is that all? Is that what love of your fellow Jew means? No problem, Paul. We got you. So I won't call upon you to read. By the way, can you all see my screen with the PDF? Yes? Yeah, perfect. Okay, great. So that is the topic of our discussion today. Do we actually have to love the other Jew? And if it is, how is that possible? I can get myself to treat you nice. I can get myself to hold my tongue when I want to say something stingy. But to actually love you, if I don't, is not the easiest thing in the world. So is that the command? So the parsha is going to talk us and teach us about this. And so we'll start off here. And as always, those who came in person get preferential treatment. No offense to those on Zoom. John, if you don't mind reading on page one, text one, if you go past, right after the introduction. Text one.
Rabbi, can you make the print bigger?
Yes, I will. Let me try. Is that better?
A little more.
Okay, let me try again.
Yeah.
Is that good? Okay. And I move this over. The side stuff, the text is usually kept at the center of the screen, so we should be good. All right. Yeah. So, John, by all means.
Sure. They journeyed from Rephidim, and they arrived in the desert of Sinai, and they camped in the desert, and Israel camped there opposite the mountain.
Okay. So the first thing we hear about is that the Jewish people came to the desert of Sinai, and they camped there. Now, this verse begs questions in the Hebrew, more in the English, I'm not sure, you can say it like this, but in Hebrew, there's a problem. The problem is that the first part of the verse is in the plural sense, right? That they came plurally to the desert of Sinai, and they camped in the desert. And then it says, and Israel camped there, and there it's camped is in the singular form, opposite the mountain. So in the original Hebrew, we have problems here with this verse, which changes the from the plural to the singular. And also we have another problem, which is, why does it have to say, and they camped there? Why can it say, and they camped opposite the mountain? Right. Once we said that the Jewish people traveled from Rephidim, arrived in the desert Sinai, and camped in the desert, and they camped opposite the mountain. Why do we have to say it twice? So it actually says it twice, and the second time it says there, as opposed to where. We're camping here, so what's going on? So that's the first just questions we have about the actual verse here. But Rashi, and Howard, if you don't mind reading our next text, number two, Rashi gives us a very interesting insight, which is a very famous insight regarding this verse.
And Israel camped there as one person with one heart. However, all the other encampments were accompanied by complaints and arguments.
Thank you. So
scroll the script.
Oh, I'm sorry. I Last week I had a break. Wasn't able to share my screen, so I have to get back into the habit. So just you can see there what Howard just read in text number two, Rashi's interpretation, which is that the fact that the Torah switches from the plural to the singular teaches us a very important lesson, which he actually borrows from the Medrash, which is that the Jewish people camped at the mountain as one person with one ark. However, as he says, this was unique. This is the only time that the Jewish people camped without bickering. But in general, it was all bickering. Now, as a side note, even though we're not going to get into it here, there's a very interesting discussion. Rashi takes this idea from the Medrash, yet the Medrash says it a little differently. And the Medrash seems to imply that the miracle here is not that they always bickered, is that when you have a group of several million people, the chances of everybody being on the same exact page, not fighting necessarily, but just being on the same page, is very unlikely. And here there was a miracle that everybody was 100% in sync. Okay, so it's not such a negative comment. But the way Rashi proposes it, it is a very negative comment that all the other encampments were accompanied by complaints and arguments, actual fighting and bickering. So Rashi points that out to us. So we see already here that at Matan Torah, at the Midbar Sinai, the Jewish people were in a heightened state of unity, right? They were all together. They were all on the same page. They were all together. Now the question is, why is this associated with what's going on in our parsha? What does it have to do with what's going on? And so, simply put, it has to do with the Torah. The Torah is of peace and of unity, and so it makes sense. It stands to reason that as preparation for receiving the Torah, the Jewish people will be unified. Charon, if you don't mind reading for us text number three, and I'll pull it up on the screen here so you guys can all can see, and I will center it. All right. Number three.
Peace is great, for the entire Torah was given to bring about peace within the world. As the verse states, its ways are pleasant and all its paths are peace.
Thank you very much. So this is a quote from Maimonides, that peace is great, and he brings a verse. And we say this, right? You all know the song. The ways of Torah are peace and pleasant. Has anybody here been in a yeshiva before? Or experienced rabbis learning on their own? You have?
I think, like, at the place in Brooklyn.
Yeah, okay.
And then there's one, like, a learning center on La Vista.
Yes. Did you notice something there interesting? Did it seem peaceful to you?
No, there was a lot of...
It's not peaceful. I learned in yeshiva for 6 years, and it's not a peaceful place. Not that it's, like, not... But the learning style, not only in the way we learn it, but the way it's written to us, is all about arguments. It's not a peaceful endeavor to study Torah. What does this mean? Everything is a question. Everything is a challenge, right? You know, the famous idea, the stereotype that a Jew always answers a question with a question. That's not a stereotype. That's the way Torah teaches us to do it. Somebody makes a statement, don't accept it, challenge it immediately. So why are we calling Torah so peaceful? And that in order to receive the Torah, we had to be unified. It seems that the Torah was very much into and is into the idea of many opinions. Now, you can argue and try to say that no. Hold on a second. God gave a Torah that's beautiful and perfect. The rabbis screwed up and started fighting, and it became about a fight because the rabbis did it. Since it's a human issue, it's not a Torah issue. So, in order to dispel that, we're going to read a quote from the Medrash. So, who from the Zoom call would like to read? The way it's on my screen, Steve, you're first. So by all means, Steve, go ahead. Text number four. Let me pull it up on the screen so everybody can see it. And here we go. Steve, you're on mute. Can I unmute you? There we go.
There, sorry.
No problem.
The words of Torah were not stated definitively. Rather, for every law that God taught Moses, he presented 49 paths in which the ruling is, it is pure, and 49 paths in which the ruling is, it is impure. Moses said to God, Master of the universe, how will we ever render a definitive ruling? God said to him, follow the majority. If the majority rules that it is impure, rule that it is impure. If the majority rules that it is pure, rule that it is pure.
Okay, newsflash. The Torah was given to be argued about. This is part of the plan. This is not a mistake. It's not a human error, a problem, a defect in us. God gave a Torah that has, as is pointed out to Moses, 49 paths of one scenario to make it pure, meaning to give a halachic ruling that it is pure, and 49 paths of impure. There's a famous statement that Shivim Panim LaTorah, the Torah has 70 faces. Everything is open for question, and that's the way God gave it to us. Just as a side note.
Rabbi.
Yes?
Where does it say that gave him 49 pro and 49 negative? Where is that written?
This is a medrash, as it says here. Let me show you the top of the page. It gives you the source. A medrash Tehillim, right? So this is the medrash is actually the either first or second Jewish literature that we have after the Torah, right? So it's whether the medrash comes before the Mishnah or after the Mishnah. But the Medrash is considered to be accepted in Jewish literature as real, and so that's where it says it. The idea of the majority rules, though, that says specifically in the Torah. It says that you should follow the majority. So that part for sure is there, and the fact that it says it in the Torah seems to imply that it's open for discussion. And Adele, let's simply ask the question here. The Torah says, the first mitzvah, what's the first mitzvah in the Torah?
You should love the Lord your God with all your heart.
No, that's the first in the Ten Commandments. The first mitzvah mentioned in the Torah. If you read the text simply, what's the first mitzvah?
Sabbath?
No, not the Sabbath.
Oh, this just came up.
It was given to Adam and Eve.
I am the Lord your God.
No, God never said that to Adam and Eve. The answer is, be fruitful and multiply. Okay, let me ask you. That's what it says in the Torah, be fruitful and multiply. Well, let me ask a simple question. What does that mean? Have kids. How many? When have I fulfilled my obligation? When have I not? Well, guess what? It's an argument. Some rabbis say you have to have a son and a daughter. Some rabbis say you have to have two sons and a daughter. Some say you have to have two sons and two daughters. I'm pretty sure that the conclusion is two sons and a daughter, you've covered all your bases and you fulfill the obligation. But the Torah doesn't say it clear. It says be fruitful and multiply. Let's talk about the other one. Charna mentioned Shabbos. Right? What does it say in the Torah about Shabbos? Keep the Shabbos. How many prohibitions does Shabbos include? Anybody?
It's an odd number. Like
Susan, you're turned off. You're muted.
19.
No, I think Susan has it, but she's picking up her hands. But she has to unmute herself. Can I unmute you? Here, I can ask you to unmute, and you'll just have to press a button. If you press your space bar, you'll be able to. Here, there you are.
39.
I'm sorry?
39.
39 is correct. That. Very good. You said 39?
I said 39.
Oh, I thought you said 18, 19.
No, I said 19.
Thank you. So Where does it come from, those 39 activities? Does it say that in the Torah? The answer is no. The Torah actually only mentions two of the 49, not lighting a fire on the Sabbath and not carrying from one domain to another. The other 37 were established by the rabbis arguing that they're biblical. And then there are rabbis that argue about which ones, and maybe only one of them is biblical. It doesn't stop every step of the way there's arguments. So this is, and it's built in, it's part of the system. And then there's another part of the system, which is that we follow the majority. Now, following the majority is not peace. There's a guy, who's an anarchist, and not what you think an anarchist, like just wants to have no laws. He believes in anarchy as a proper system. His argument is, I don't want to accept a president that I didn't vote for. The fact that the majority of us accepted this person as the president doesn't mean he should be my president. I never agreed to that. I didn't agree that that person should be in charge of me. I'm not getting into political discussions. I'm saying is that he has a point, which is the fact that majority rule is not a peaceful situation, right? If we have, we're sitting here at a group of people and we're I'm having an argument about something and we take a vote and we come to a majority vote, well, the people that were not part of the majority have gotten, in a way, not bamboozled, but they got overridden, right? They were forced, they are forced not to participate in something that they didn't want to. So it's not a peaceful situation. So we have to understand that. And so how do we say that the Torah is a Torah of peace? It seems to be not very peaceful. Okay, so we've established that. All right. So let's add one more component to what we're discussing here, and then we're going to be able to really get into the meat and potatoes, as they say. You know the only thing better than meat and potatoes, right? Only thing better than meat and potatoes? Meat and meat. Okay. I think that was an old Budweiser commercial. It's like, all right. So if I can ask somebody else from the Zoom, maybe Adele, because you're unmuted and ready to go, to read us text number 5 on your screen.
Yes. In the third month of the children of Israel's departure from Egypt, on this day they arrived in the desert of Sinai.
Thank you. So there seems to be, and as we just said about nitpicking everything in Torah, we also nitpick here. Why does the Torah say in the third month of the Jews exiting Egypt, they came to the desert? Why doesn't it say when the Jews came to the desert in the third month, they arrived in Sinai? Now, it's not a question in the sense of both can work, but it seems to be that there's an emphasis here on focusing on the fact that it was the third month, which of course brings us to text number 6. And maybe Donna, you can read for us text number 6.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Sure.
It says, on this day, in the third month,
wait, it's,
on this day.
So actually the rabbis teach us that it's referring to the first day of the month. The Jews arrived on the first, and because there's another reference to this day, and the rabbis learned from it that this day means the first day of the month, which fits into the chronological order. The Jews arrived at Mount Sinai on this on the first day of Sivan. They had a couple of days rest, and then God commanded them to prepare for 3 days, right? So they were, there was no marital relations. They had to wash and clean, etc. And then after the third day, they received the Torah. And so that's what we're actually going to see in text number 6. Donna, floor is yours.
Okay. Blessed is the merciful one who gave a threefold Torah to a threefold nation by means of a third born on the third day in the third month.
Okay, so a lot of threes. Thank you, Donna. So we see here, this is our final component in our salad that we're trying to, dish that we're trying to make here. And that is that 3 seems to be an important number here. And as the rabbis tell us, we're thanking God who gave us a threefold Torah. Why is it a threefold Torah? Because the Torah is divided in Tanakh, right? The Torah Nevi'im Ksuvim. It's the written Torah is divided into 3 groups, right? I think it's the Pentateuch, prophets, and writings, right? I think is the way it's translated into English. And then a people of 3, which are, why are there people of 3? Why are we a people of 3? Anybody? We are Kohen, Levi, and Yisrael, right? The 3 types or general types of Jews within Yiddishkeit. By a third born, Moshe was the third born child, right? He was the third. It actually says, by the way, that the third calf is considered to be the best calf. A cow, a birthing cow, The third calf is considered to be the healthiest, best one. I was always told this because I'm the third born, and out of my family, I'm the only one who was ever chubby. So I was, they always used to make fun of me, I'm the third cow. Sometimes in a nice way, maybe sometimes not, who cares? No, it's all good. by a third born, on the third day, and as we just said, it's the third day of their preparation, in the third month of their exodus from Egypt. Okay, so we see three seems to be a big deal here. Now comes a very simple question. Torah being peaceful, coming from God, the uniqueness, when we look at Torah, is and we always talk about this, monotheism, right? Abraham is lauded for coming up with monotheism. Everybody there before were pagans and idol worshippers, and Avram was the monotheistic. So one is the big number. And yet the Torah is all about threes. And again, which seems to go very contrary, right? The idea of the Trinity, right? Why are you mixing it in? No, let's focus on unity, on oneness. So to summarize, what we have here is the fact that the Jewish people were gathered as one, and only here were they one at Mount Sinai, and preparation for receiving the Torah, which the Torah is supposedly peaceful, yet we find that the Torah is not so peaceful. It's all about arguments and majority rule, which in a way is mob rule. And then also the idea of the threes, that there seems to be a lot of emphasis, and we're praising the Torah because of threes. So we have to understand all these things, and we have to come up with an idea. Go ahead.
It seemed like a break.
No, you can, anytime.
You said three, Kohan, Levi, and Israel.
Right.
What is, I thought there were 12.
No, right. So that's a good question. In general, in Judaism, as far as holiness is concerned, there are three layers. Like, for example, when we go up to the Torah, we have three layers of preference. We have a Kohen first, then a Levi, then an Israel. A closeness to God as a standard state. A Kohen works inside the temple, does the sacrifices, very much involved. The Levite, works also in the temple, but on the outskirts, more involved in song, and has less rules, but still more rules than the Israelite. And then you have the Israelite, which is just basically everybody else. So as far as from a Judaism treatment, there is a difference only in these three. Within the tribes themselves, there's no Jewish law difference between the tribe of Reuven and the tribe of Shimon. It's the same.
So in the previous text where they talked about they camped and Israel camped.
Right. It's the entirety of the Jewish people.
Right. But maybe that's beyond the scope of this. How do we know they're not referring to everybody but the Kohens?
No, because so the Torah does give us the description of the traveling process of the Jews in the desert. Right, they were camped right in the surrounding, and it included the entire Jewish people, including the Levites and the Kohens.
So it's referring when it says Israel
in
that.
In this case, as far as traveling and camping, it was everybody together, as we describe later in the Torah the specifics of the how travel worked, the travel arrangements of the Jewish people. So okay, thank you. We can listen. There's no way this. All right. So threes. What's so special about threes? So you see here, they think of threesome unity and three unity, because we're very careful not to, God forbid, use anything that's associated with anything else. But it's just a general question of three layers of unity. You have, three layers to arrive at unity. You have one, which is absolute unity. We have two, which is the opposite of unity. Right, so like when we have, and then we have three, which represents symbiosis. So if you think about it, even like in cells, right? Is once you have one cell, is a single cell organism, is absolute unity. You break into two, now there's a contradiction, and then there's three, and suddenly there's something beautiful, right? It turns into something. Three words can form a sentence, rather than two words seem to just be two random words. One word, of course, is just one word, and this goes on and on. We see this. The idea is there's two layers of unity. There's unity of oneness without anything else. That's one. And there's unity of multiple, which is the unity of three. And so we find this actually in the Torah itself, and speaking of the Torah and how it's learned, we say this in the morning. If you ever came to prayers early, and we're reading the prayers, there's a section there that we quote from the Braisa, which is the 13 attributes that the Torah is learned, 13 rules. There's a system of how to read the Torah and how to derive halachic rulings from. And one of them is, which we're going to read, if somebody can volunteer, I think everybody had a chance to read already. No, Susan, you didn't read yet, right? So Susan, if you can read it for us, text number 7, that would be great.
The Torah is expounded by means of 13 rules. 13. When two verses contradict each other, the meaning can be determined by a third verse that reconciles them.
Thank you. So we only talked about the 13 rule. There's of course, the rule of Kal v'chomer. Kal v'chomer, it has a very fancy Italian word or Latin word. Paupuri, parapuri. There's a fancy word to say Kal v'chomer. Lamsha, I'm sorry. I should have looked it up before. It's a cool word. Nobody uses it ever, but it's still a cool word. There are many rules of how do we play with the texts. For example, there's texts that we play with that if they only have one part placed in the Torah where it says something, then that becomes the source material for anything else in Torah that's not said explicitly, but that somehow relates to it. There are many things like this, and we're going to give the example that we're talking about here, the example of when you have two verses in the Torah that contradict each other, you cannot reconcile them until a third verse comes and reconciles them for you. So, the Torah actually gives us an example in this week's parsha of this ruling, which is going to help us understand. So, it's right here. I think we're done on the poll city. It's having problems with audio. So, John, if you don't mind reading for us, text number 8.
God descended upon Mount Sinai to the peak of the mountain.
Thank you. Howard, can you jump to text number 9, please?
God said to Moses, so shall you say to the children of Israel, you have seen that from the heavens I have spoken with you.
Hold on a second. We just read in text number 8 that God descended upon the Mount Sinai to the peak of the mountain. The peak of the mountain is not the heavens. And yet the next verse says that God spoke to the Jewish people, says to tell Moses to repeat the Jewish people, I spoke to you from the heavens, or from the heavens I have spoken to you. So we have two contradictory verses. One says one thing, the other says another thing. We can't reconcile them. It's one or the other. And so immediately we have two verses. Charn, if you don't mind reading text 10a and text 10b.
From the heavens he let you hear his voice to instruct you, and upon the earth he showed you his great fire. His glory was in heaven, his fire and his power were on the earth.
Thank you. So we see here, we have a third verse, which is text 10a, which says, from the heavens he let you hear his voice, and upon the earth he showed you his great fire. So we seem to hear already, there's already a reconcile, where we're talking about both things in the same verse. And as Rashi points out to us and explains to us, his glory, the holiness, was in the heavens, and his fire and power, the thunder and the shaking, the trembling, was on the earth. So we had one verse that said one thing, another verse that said another thing, a third verse that reconciled the two and gave us a clear understanding. Yes, God descended on the mountain. What descended? His might in the material world, the thunder and the lightning and the trembling. And he spoke to us from heaven, meaning we heard it coming from the sky. Okay? But here's the rule. Now, in this case, it doesn't make much of a difference halachically. There's no difference to us to what happened in the story of Mount Sinai for our practical behavior. But there are cases where this happens, where there are halachic rulings, where you have the same idea. You have two verses that seem to contradict each other, and the rabbis find a third verse that actually reconciles the two, and that's what we learn from. Now, what's key that we notice here is we had two opposing ideas, right? God descended from heaven, or God stayed in heaven and spoke to us from heaven. Our reconcile did not choose or rule as one of the two. It reconciled. meaning both opinions are still in the room. We haven't kicked anybody out. I think I have time. I want to tell you a cool story about this. I don't know if it's going to add anything, but I think it's a cool story to understand how halacha works, at least. There was a rabbi who was the rabbi of the town, and the rabbi of the town used to be a very different position than it is today. Today, what we have in the old days were referred to as a magid and a parnas. The rabbi today is the pulpit rabbi, meaning he gives lectures and speeches in order to inspire the community. And he's also an administrator of the runnings of the synagogue, right? He's the ultimate CEO. The rabbi in the shtetl was very much focused on halachic problems, very, very much focused on the laws of kosher meat. So the way it worked is, you went to the shochet, you went to the slaughterer, I think that's the way to say that, and he would slaughter your animal, and then you would take the animal home, and you would then clean it, and salt it, and inspect it to conclude if it's kosher or not. Most women in Jewish times were very learned with these laws because they knew how to check chickens, and they can tell you if a chicken was kosher or not. On occasion, they had a problem and they didn't know the answer, or there was some unique, mutation in the animal. They would bring it to the rabbi for the rabbi to make the ruling about this animal. So our rabbi in our story is sitting in the base medrash, and a woman comes in with the lungs of a cow and is asking, is this situation kosher or not? And so the rabbi says, it's kosher. And she leaves. And she's very happy, of course, because otherwise, there was no resale market. There would have been a lost cow, but she's very happy. But the students are in a uproar against the rabbi. And they said, Rabbi, this situation that just came before us is discussed in the halachic text. And pretty much all the rabbis agree that this situation is not kosher, except one rabbi. How did you go with the minority opinion in this case? And so the rabbi said, I'll explain to you what happened. He says, what's going to happen now? Right? I ruled against the majority of rabbis and ruled with the minority. After 120, I'm going to come up to heaven. And I'm going to be judged, and they're going to judge me and challenge me on this ruling that I just made. And they're going to say, how did you make this ruling that one person, that only one person agrees to and everybody else disagrees? And so I'm going to, of course, tell them to bring all the rabbis that say that this is not kosher, and we're going to, hash it out. And it's going to be beautiful. We're going to have a ton of Torah and discussion, and it'll be amazing for me. I'll have a lot of fun. But let's give the alternative version of the story. I would have ruled here that this cow is not kosher, like the majority. And I would then come 120, and I would be challenged in heaven about this ruling. And who would they bring? They would bring the cow, because the cow was ruled not kosher. And I'm going to have to explain to the cow, why did I rule like the majority, and why it didn't make it kosher. And he says, I don't want to argue with a cow. And that's the reason for his ruling. There's no point to this story. It's just a story. But we have to understand how halacha works. Halacha works is that there's many, many opinions. And yes, we do use the majority to determine the halacha. But it doesn't mean that the opinions that we didn't rule according to are no longer relevant. Like, case in point, our story with the cow, you can, in certain scenarios, rely on the minority opinion if it is necessary. And that's the rabbi's discretion to decide, right? The rabbi has the ability, when there was a ruling made, the general ruling is so-and-so, but in certain cases, he can rely on other opinions. That means that those opinions never became irrelevant. Just practically speaking, in order for us to act out Judaism, we have to make a practical ruling. We have to choose and say, okay, this is the law. But it doesn't mean that the other person is wrong. When two rabbis are arguing, it doesn't. And somebody says, this way. It doesn't mean the other one is wrong. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. And we see this that throughout history, the rabbis fully accepted, even minority opinions, accepted the rulings of the rabbi. There's a famous story of a rabbi who, there was a discussion about a cow, talking about the Shabbos, a cow having like a ribbon on its horns. Is it allowed to go out on Shabbos with it? Now, generally speaking, we're responsible for our animals' keeping of the Shabbos, right? We're not allowed to allow our ox to work on Shabbos for us. Frankly, we shouldn't allow, if you have a dog or a cat, to allow them to desecrate the Shabbos. You know, if you keep Shabbos to whatever extent you do, you should keep your animals, should keep Shabbos in the same way. Shouldn't have your animals turn on the lights, literally. This is not a, you know, I'm being very serious about this. But at the same time, there's a discussion regarding a ribbon. Is it considered to be an act of work, and therefore the animal's not allowed to do it? Or is it considered to be just a decoration or like a clothing almost, and therefore it's not a problem? Well, the rabbis ruled that you're not allowed to do this. You have to take off the ribbon because it was used for, related to work. And this rabbi, who was the minority, who disagreed with the rabbis, saw his neighbor's cow being let out for a walk in the street, and it had the ribbon. And he, being that he believed that this is not a problem, he did not reprimand her. He didn't tell her, oh, that's a problem. And he was so distraught by the fact that he did not hold up his friend's opinion based on the majority rule that it said he fasted for 40 days or he fasted until his teeth became black. The point was he took this very seriously not to support the opinion of the majority, even if he was the minority, right? Meaning even though he opposed them and he had logical reason to oppose them, he still accepted. So we see that it's not an argument. There's no fight here. There seems to be a unifying situation here but of multiple opinions. And if, for example, there's another case that we're brought here about this idea. I don't know if we have time for all of this, but let me try and see what happens. A more intense story of what just happened here. Are you guys familiar how we sanctify the new moon? In general terms, yeah? Everybody here?
Not me.
Okay, very, very simply put, in order, we follow the lunar calendar, and the way the Torah describes for us to do it is that on the first day of the month, which is the day that the moon appears for the first time after it disappears, witnesses have to come to the court and bear witness and testify that they saw the new moon. And if they did, then we establish that day as the first day of the next month. If no witnesses come, it was a cloudy night, nobody saw the sky, then we don't make the first day of the month that day, but rather the next day. Now, this is very practical. I mean, it makes a very practical difference because we have holidays that are set to days of the month. So which day do you celebrate? For example, Yom Kippur is the 10th day of the month of Tishrei. Now, if you decide that the first day of the month is Sunday, right, then Yom Kippur comes out to be on Tuesday the next week. However, Sunday is not Rosh Chodesh and we didn't get any witnesses and it comes the second day, it comes Monday, then Wednesday is Yom Kippur. And one is a regular day and one is a holy day. Okay. There was a situation in Yerushalayim where there was a confusion and there was an argument about which day it was based on the witnesses. All the details are not as relevant. The bottom line was there was a big argument and there was a ruling made by the majority that certain day was the first day of the month, and therefore Yom Kippur would be on the whichever day would be. And the leading rabbi at the time was Rabbi Gamliel, and the leader of the opposition in this case was a man named Rabbi Yehoshua. And Rabbi Gamliel announced publicly, and we can actually read this. I don't remember who read last. Charna read last. So, Steve, you want to pick this one up for us? Text number 11. And I'll pull it up on the screen so those who are watching can read it.
Well, okay. Rabbi Gamliel sent a message to Rabbi Yehoshua. I decree against you that you must appear before me with your staff and with your money on the day on which Yom Kippur occurs according to your calculations. Rabbi Yehoshua sent his staff and his money in his hand and went to Yevna to Rabbi Gamliel on the day on which the Yom Kippur occurred according to his calculation. Upon seeing him, Rabbi Gamliel stood up and kissed him on his head. He said to him, "Come in peace, my teacher and my student. You are my teacher in wisdom, and you are my student, as you accepted my statement."
Thank you. So that's the story that happened, and that was the end of the story, that, as Steve just read. So the question we should ask ourselves is, was Rabbi Gamliel trying to, you know, humiliate Rabbi Yeshua and point out how wrong he was? And even if that was the case, wouldn't that be sufficient to just tell him, you have to celebrate Yom Kippur according to my opinion? What was the whole idea of making him come up with his staff and his money? And the answer to that is, Rabbi Gamliel wanted Rabbi Yeshua not only to do what was concluded by the majority in a way of accepting it against his will, but rather to fully embrace it. You know, we were here, we talked about that story, right, with the rabbi. You're right, and you're also right, right? That the wife and the husband and the rabbi's wife. Everybody is right. And Rabbi Yeshua had to show that he's also part of the right, meaning his opinion is real, it's true, and yet he's going to behave fully and wholeheartedly the way Rabbi Gamliel wanted him to. Because that's the way Torah works. Torah works, I can disagree with you, and we have an argument, halachically, we have a vote, whatever it is, we come to a conclusion, and whatever the conclusion is, we have to accept it. Fully. And not I'm right and wrong, because at this point, it's not about right or wrong. Everybody's right. Nobody is wrong. But we have to rule one way. So what does that mean? That means that there's a level of peace that comes from not negating one side, and not reconciling to the where the opposition knows no longer opposition, but that we all work together. If you will, you know, America, we're at a cusp, I think, of a discussion here. And again, I don't want to get political, so this is not meant to be political, but I think it's a very interesting observation, which is that America is very much focused on diversity, right? We always were. America was and is a melting pot of cultures and of races and of religions and so on and so forth, and ideas. And we want it to remain that way. Yet America has unifying values. So there are unifying values, and there's a emphasis of diversity. Both can be true. We can be unified in what we want while keeping our own diversity. Meaning, I don't have to accept your way of life for us to accept mutually a unified vision of what we want this place to look like, right? We can be friends and love our neighbors that are different religions. And as famously the, I can't remember which group it was, very much supported the KKK march. It was a Jewish organization. And they said that if they can't walk and speak what they want to speak, then we're not going to be able to speak what we need to speak when the time comes. And I don't forget who it was, but this is a famous idea, meaning we want that. We want people to be able to express themselves. At the same time, we want to be unified. So we have these two opposed, but perfect unity means that we are able to maintain our differences and ultimately even have to choose a way to behave. We have to agree, right? It's like we can't be everything. You know, we have so many issues that it's either one or the other. There's no reconcile to be had. You either are pro it or against it. And I'm not going to mention any of them because it's irrelevant. The point is, at some point, we're going to have to agree and make a ruling if it will be pro or against, if we'll allow this or not. And we have to, as a people, accept that. And the ultimate unity is where we accept, hey, this is what our courts decided. I disagree. I think that we should do otherwise, but I'm fully going to embrace the whatever conclusion was. And that's how Torah works. And that's the ultimate piece, a three-pronged piece. We have two sides, and we come together in one. So what do we see here? So the unity of Torah, which seems to be focused on this, we touched on two points. On the argument in Torah, right? Which means built into Torah, and it's not opposition to unity. The idea of multiple ideas and opinions working together. And we talked about the three. Why the emphasis on three, right? So we've touched on those already, sort of gotten the answer. So now we come to our conclusion, which is these levels of unities are actually talked about in the Torah. And we find it here We're going to start with text number 13. Adele, would you like to read text? I'm sorry, the text 12, please.
Yes. It came to pass at the end of 430 years, and it came to pass on that very day that all the legions of God went out of the land of Egypt.
Thank you. So here we're referring to the first month from the Jews leaving Egypt, which is the month of Nisan. And we find here a level of unity which is pure. Meaning, everybody, all the legions of God went out of the land of Egypt. Everybody that came out, now we talked about the fact there are some people left behind. We're not going to get into that right now. But the way the Torah says it, all the legions of God went out of Egypt. All those Jews, when they were leaving, were in the same state. They were absolutely one and nullified by God's revelation and presence. So there was nothing for them there was no diversity. There was no uniqueness. There was just oneness. It actually started breaking apart when they reached 7 days later, when they reached the Dead Sea, the Sea of Reeds, and they were divided into four camps. But actually, God said, no, now is not the time for division. Now is absolute unity. That is the month of Nisan. Then we have the month of Iyar, which the month of Iyar is all about division, if you will, and uniqueness and individualism. It's all about developing your own characters and focusing on counting the Omer, which is all about the specifics and very, very focused details. And then comes the month of Sivan. Donna or Susan, I don't know if Paul, you got your system working, but if either of you can read text number 13.
I'm back.
Oh, there we go, Paul. So please, you hadn't had a chance to read yet.
Yes, okay. Following Nisan and Elah comes the month of Sivan, the third month, the month of the giving of the Torah. Torah unifies all Jews in a manner of one heart, namely, notwithstanding the different temperaments of different Jews, which can at times even lead to complaints and arguments. The Torah creates peace among these different temperaments to the point of being unified with one heart, a true peace.
Thank you. So what we're being taught here and what we were being brought to in the third month specifically, and it had to be the third month, and it had to be the third person, and the third nation of threes, et cetera, et cetera, is because the focus of Matan Torah is to tell us that we can be unified in spite of not agreeing. In spite of having different opinions, we can still be unified. It's like, you know, we don't have to get into this. Siblings, we know this all the time. If you have siblings, you know you can hate your sibling and love them at the same time. Not sometimes I hate them and sometimes I love them. At the same time, I love him and I hate him at the same time. It's just the way it works. Why? We're capable of this. Because of the threes. That's what God gave us by Matan Torah. He said, I don't want unity in the month of Nisan, which is a spiritual unity, where we're sort of leaving our bodies and focusing only on our soul. Right? For example, as we'll see in text 14, we still have some people who haven't read twice. So, Idana or Susan, if you'd like to read text 14.
I'll read 14.
Please.
There's a direct and easy path toward fulfilling the mitzvah, love your fellow as yourself, with regard to every Jew, great or small. For in reality, we are all equal, and we all have one father. Therefore, all Jewish people are called siblings, in the full sense of the word, for we all share a common root in the one God. Only our bodies are distinct from each other.
Thank you. But this is not enough. Because this love of your fellow Jew is by not seeing the body, not seeing the human and the different person in front of me, but only looking at their soul. So love my fellow Jew by ignoring them as a human being and focusing on the fact that they're a soul just like me and really one soul. That's still not enough. That is not what the story of the Jewish people coming to the mountain teaches us. What the story teaches us, what the Torah teaches us in this story, is that true peace and true love of your fellow Jew is loving your friend with all their flaws and your disagreements. Not reconciling them, not overlooking them, but loving them for what they are. Right? As and I'm going to quote Goodwill Hunting as the therapist, I forgot what they call Robin Williams, but in right, he was talking about his wife, and he was telling the boy that what he remembers about his dead wife was not the amazing times they had together, but her the little things that annoyed him about her. And that's what he was connected to. That's what he loved, the way she behaved in certain ways. Meaning there's true peace and true love is not overlooking the flaws, is about being unified together with the flaws. And that's why the Torah is teaching us this lesson here in this parsha as a preparation for Matan Torah. The Torah is a way of peace. And what kind of peace? The peace of threes. A three unity, as they tried calling it here, right? The idea of unity, not from not noticing anything, but the unity from really being all together. Torah is one, not because we ignore the minority opinion, but rather because we accept and include the minority opinion, even though we don't rule like them. And this works the same way if we have to kick out the person that we disagree with, in whatever side of whatever opinion you're on any issue you're on, then we haven't made peace. Peace means we're all together, we accept each other as we are, with what we are, with our flaws, with our deficiencies, and that is Avos Yisrael, and that's what Torah is, and that's what the Jewish people were being taught, and we've been trying to accomplish since then, albeit not very successfully. Unfortunately, usually we accept ourselves with our flaws when something bad happens. Hopefully, we can learn from this that Torah is a way of peace, and it's not a way of peace of ignoring the fact that we have difference of opinions, but rather by embracing and loving our fellow with all of their other opinions and their flaws and their deficiencies. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
That's aspirational. We are far as a people. We are. But
we've been talking about the last few weeks. We kept talking about this, that we, being that we're Jews, we're capable of doing the impossible. We're capable, and if we accept that we're capable of doing the impossible, we will. If we keep telling ourselves that we're not capable, then we won't be. But we are, we can accept each other no matter what. And we can overcome all the hate, especially to our fellow Jews, and by extension, affect the world, right? Our goal is that we should be a light unto the nations, and everybody should embrace this. We're living in a time where there's no reason why we should all not have enough food and enough medical support. I mean, we live in a crazy time of abundance that we've never seen in history, and yet we're bickering about the most stupid things in the world. Like, that's just, you know, like the famous therapist Bob Newhart, I think, said that, just stop it. Just stop it, right? We should just stop it. And again, just stop it means not ignoring the flaws. That's the crazy thing. Like, I can disagree with you. I have friends, a lot of them, that we disagree vehemently about a lot of issues. And I love them no less.
This can prove fatal for local villagers.
Oh.
Neil, a member of the Max Planck team, explains.
I'm not sure what's going on, but thank you all. Have a great week.
Appreciate it.
And appreciate you all for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.